A War Without a Name still claims lives, which is what I spoke about with Matty Friedman when he was a guest on our show last May. Mr. Friedman had just published a memoir called Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story, and in it, he recreated the harrowing experiences of a band of young soldiers charged with defending an outpost in Israel's security zone in Lebanon. Although it was never declared an official war, it changed these men and Israel forever. Matty Friedman is a former correspondent for the Associated Press, where he reported throughout the Middle East. He's also the author of the award-winning book, The Aleppo Codex. We're rebroadcasting my conversation with him now. Pumpkin Flowers is an unusual title. What's the story behind it?
The language of the Israeli military is oddly floral. So code names for things tend to not be like American names, Hellfire or Predator. They tend to be more botanical. So the outposts in South Lebanon in the 1990s all had kind of perky bed and breakfast-like names, like Pumpkin, which was the outpost where I served. There were other outposts called Red Pepper, Citrus, and Cypress. Flowers was the code word on the military frequencies for casualties.
Flowers.
Flowers.
When were you stationed there? Was it before you joined the AP?
Yes, it was long before I was drafted into the military in Israel when I was 19 in 1997, and I served until 2000.
And what was the outpost there for? Who was the enemy?
The enemy in those years was Hezbollah, the Shiite guerrilla organization. There was a small guerrilla war that unfolded in South Lebanon throughout the 1990s, culminating in an Israeli withdrawal in the spring of 2000.
And you say that their war didn't have an end goal. It was just a kind of a way of life.
It had begun with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. There was supposed to be a withdrawal in 1984, but the army never really left, and instead a kind of static war took shape in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, in which soldiers at these isolated outposts inside South Lebanon waged an on-again, off-again war with guerrillas from Hezbollah.
This is something that was debated in the Israeli government. The 1984 resolution authorized a security zone that would be the responsibility of the South Lebanese Army and Christian militia. And it called for the support of the Israeli Defense Forces. But the IDF was doing a lot more than support, according to what you're describing here.
It's kind of a lesson in unintended consequences.
Why didn't the IDF just withdraw and do what it had said it was going to do?
I think that the army thought that the border, the security of the border, of Israel's northern border, could not ultimately be left to Israel's allied militia in South Lebanon, and it needed the support of the Israel Defense Forces. What that support entailed changed over time from an advisory role, similar to the advisory role envisioned by the United States in Vietnam in the early 1960s, and then you send in more advisors, and then combat support, and then actual troops. And by the 1990s, we had a whole military array in South Lebanon, outposts, ambushes, convoys, a whole world that became really the center of the emotional universe for any Israeli who turned 18 and was drafted in the 1990s.
Well, you were born and raised in Toronto, Canada. How did you wind up in this outpost?
I left Toronto when I was 17 after finishing high school, and I went to Israel for a year and ended up staying. And when I became an Israeli citizen, I became subject to the draft and joined the army when I was 19.
Everybody is subject to the draft with religious exemptions, and that's men and women. How long is mandatory service?
It's 3 years for men and 2 years for women.
And then people serve in reserve units after that.
That's right.
You note that reservists are more inclined to complain to elected officials if they disagree with policy. But as new recruits, you pretty much had no idea what you were doing there. You write, there was no ideology at all at that outpost, as far as I could see. For this generation, Ben-Gurion and Herzl were streets.
there was very little discussion of ideology at the outpost. I think that at the time we did have an idea of why we were in this outpost. We looked north and we saw Hezbollah territory. We looked south and over about 5 miles of hostile territory, I could see the houses in Israel. So it was clear to us that we were standing in between the bad guys and our guys. That made a lot of sense to us at the time. Of course, the realities of our situation were far more complicated.
You also describe yourself as green and innocent when you arrived, but a year later, already wizened soldiers dealing with new recruits who were green and innocent.
That's right. That's the way the army works.
Now, the first part of the book you tell from Avi's point of view. Who was he, and why didn't you just tell it from your own?
The book ends up being a mix of memoir, which is about my own experiences, and journalism reported work about the experiences of other soldiers who served on this same hill called Outpost Pumpkin. Avi was another soldier who served at the outpost from 1994 to 1997, which is when I got there. He was a unique character not only because he saw a series of very interesting and ultimately devastating events on the hill, but because he was a great writer, or at least beginning to be a great writer. He was a guy with an anti-establishment attitude. He didn't like the military, and he had the capacity, which is very rare in a 19 or 20-year-old kid, to stand apart from himself and from his friends and kind of see the sweep of events with a very mature and very critical and even cynical eye.
And you got that from letters he wrote, because you describe his inner thoughts, his dreams, his goal to go to Ireland of all places.
His dream was to go to Ireland and ultimately to Alaska. He wrote a series of letters to a friend of his in Israel, which are uniquely insightful and well written, far beyond what most of us could have produced at that age, certainly me.
Ireland is a wonderful country, but it's not the country I would guess many young Israelis would imagine going to.
Most Israelis, when they're finished with the army, go to the Far East to backpack around India or Nepal. Avi was a unique character. He read a great deal. He read a lot of literature, not just from Israel, but from places like France and Britain. And for whatever reason, he became fixated on Ireland as the place where he would end up after the army.
There's a striking section where you write that being in the army is like living in abject poverty.
In retrospect, that's one of the things that makes that experience worthwhile. Your life is not your own. You're exhausted. You're hungry. You reach levels of desperation and despondence that are quite extreme. It's not poverty. You know it's going to end once you're out of the army, but it's an insight into a very difficult kind of life that I think is helpful after your discharge.
My guest is Mati Friedman. His latest book, Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story. You talk a lot about the military term readiness with dawn. What does that mean, and why is it important?
One of the striking things about serving in any army, and it's true of the American Army as well, is that occasionally you can find strange examples of poetry in the military jargon, most of which is very utilitarian. Every morning at Outpost Pumpkin began with a tradition called Readiness with Dawn, which involved everyone waking up and putting on combat gear and preparing for a potential assault on the outpost. And we ended up kind of standing in the trenches around the outpost and watching the landscape and waiting for something to happen, which it never did when I was there, and not in that way, and it became a time for contemplation. And I've never forgotten that experience of waking up every day watching the sunrise as we peered out into these hostile hills and waited for something to happen.
Although that's a perfect example of military jargon. We have a whole bunch in this country, like snafu. There's also drop and pop and scoot and shoot. And drop and pop is the U.S. military slang for improvised explosive devices, IEDs. What's the Israeli name for them?
We called them in the 90s, before the term IEDs came into common usage, we called it in Hebrew mit'an, which means payload. That was the army euphemism for bomb.
And this is something you had to be very concerned about.
Certainly, the roads in Lebanon were full of them, and I was in an armored vehicle in 1998 that was destroyed by one of them.
You write, I'm quoting, "Anyone looking for the origins of the Middle East of today would do well to look closely at the events in this book."
I think that's true. If you been following the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past decade and a half. As someone who knows something about South Lebanon in the 90s, it all looks very familiar. The war that we were thrown into in the 90s involved IEDs and videotaped attacks and hit and run and a modern military on hostile territory fighting a long and ultimately hopeless war against an enemy that seems weaker but ends up being more determined. And it ends, of course, with a withdrawal.
It's kind of like the war right now against ISIS.
That's right. That's right. So the 21st century, as viewed from South Lebanon, looks very familiar. And it's quite clear to me that that little war that was never given a name was actually the first war of the 21st century.
Hezbollah rebroadcast endlessly about an attack it had filmed. It attacked an army patrol, killed soldiers, and planted a Hezbollah flag on the outpost. Was that a blueprint for many of the jihadi attacks we see today?
Absolutely. There was an attack at Outpost Pumpkin on October 29th, 1994, where guerrillas stormed the outpost, planted a flag in the embankments of the outpost, and then ran away, having videotaped the planting of the flag. And it was an early example of perception warfare. They claimed to have captured the outpost, and they had a video showing them planting a flag on the outpost. In fact, they never set foot in the outpost, but it turned out not to matter.
Well, what was the reaction in Israel, the army and the general public?
We were stuck in the 20th century, and Hezbollah had advanced to the 21st. The army insisted that nothing had happened. There had just been a repulsed attack at a small outpost in Lebanon. But the strong images that Hezbollah produced from that attack, the image of their fighter driving a flag into an Israeli outpost, portrayed that operation as a victory for Hezbollah, and it was accepted as such, not just across the Arab world, where it was greeted with applause. It was accepted as a Hezbollah victory in Israel, where the incident became known as the disgrace, because Hezbollah understood something that I think few others did at the time, which is that it doesn't matter what happened. It doesn't matter. If you can produce a good image, then what actually happened doesn't matter.
You're right. The security zone was not the solution to a problem. It was the problem. Are you saying that, in your opinion, Israel hadn't established these outposts in Lebanon? If it hadn't established them, there wouldn't have been this war?
Looking at the Middle East, it's very difficult to say what decision would have led to what outcome.
But Hezbollah wouldn't have had the opportunity to demonstrate its tactics and prove their effectiveness and film them.
In retrospect, I think that's right. The outposts which were created to protect the border in fact created a more potent enemy that threatened the border. And again, it's a lesson in unintended consequences and more proof, as if any were needed, that you can initiate military action, but the results are impossible to predict.
At the end of Avi's story, you describe a collision between two helicopters that killed 73 soldiers as they were leaving Pumpkin. Now, why use helicopters? Because there was a fear that a convoy would have to deal with IEDs along the road?
That's correct. The roads were becoming increasingly dangerous in Lebanon as Hezbollah perfected the art of the IED. IEDs that, by the way, would appear afterwards in Iraq.
Helicopters turned out not to be safer.
That's right. So the irony was that the army began flying the garrisons into Lebanon on big transport helicopters. And in February 1997, two of them collided and 73 soldiers were killed.
After he attended all of the funerals of his colleagues, Avi returned to Pumpkin. And he was asked by a reporter, how did you go back after the accident? And what did he say?
That soldier was actually Harel, who was my platoon commander. He was asked in a TV interview, how on earth did you go back to the army after the deaths of all of your friends from your platoon? And he kind of waited for a moment, and there might have been a flicker of disdain in his eyes, but he betrayed no emotion, and he said, on the bus.
Kind of Israeli humor.
Indeed.
This also was the time of the four mothers on kibbutzim who opposed the war in Lebanon. One had lost a son, and they organized opposition to the war. Wasn't it rare for Israelis to oppose military actions?
To that point, yes. The instance of the Four Mothers protest movement was really the first time that a group of of Israeli civilians impacted military policy in that way. The Four Mothers believed that the army's occupation of South Lebanon was not saving lives but costing them. It began with a very small group of people. No one listened to them at first, but over a period of 2 or 3 years, they managed to shift public opinion to the point where a withdrawal from Lebanon became a popular position and wasn't eventually carried out in the spring of 2000.
Isn't one of the generals who strongly opposed the Four Mothers now a teacher who points to their protests as a great example of democracy?
Yes.
So has Israel changed or just that general?
No, Israel has changed. Israel has changed. The faith that, or the blind faith that people used to have in the institutions of the state has changed as people have become more critical and smarter and less inclined to accept as the word of God any political decision or military decision.
When you were there, did you have to deal with any attacks from Hezbollah? Because you tell one story of they thought that there were three guerrillas fighters who were going to attack, and it turned out that they were actually wild boars.
We were called out of the outpost one night after another outpost spotted using a thermal sight three gorillas, or what they thought were gorillas, approaching our outpost. We set out in an armored personnel carrier. We hit three IEDs that destroyed the vehicle. Because the vehicle was so heavily armored, no one in the vehicle was hurt. The vehicle was towed back to the outpost, and the next morning, trackers went out to see what exactly had happened. The IEDs were very real, but the gorillas who had been spotted the night before, who were the reason that we'd been sent out of the outpost, turned out to have been wild boars.
You returned to Canada, got reacquainted with Canadian accents, started saying aboot again, and then you traveled back to the area, but to Lebanon as a tourist. Was anyone aware of the fact that you were Jewish?
No, I didn't tell anyone where I was from and what I'd been up to for the past few years.
But you say the people you met were very warm but very anti-Semitic.
The people who I met in Lebanon couldn't have been lovelier. I was constantly being invited to picnics and invited to people's homes. The kindness of the people of that country was striking. And yes, many of my conversations had two recurring themes. One was that people wanted to know if I agreed with them that Lebanon was beautiful, and I did. I believed Lebanon was beautiful and that the people were wonderful. And they wanted to make sure that I was of the right political opinions. And this often took the form of unfortunate comments, not just about Israel, but about Jews.
Thank you so much, Mati, for being on our show.
It was a real pleasure.